That's better. Hi, everybody. Bob Claster here with the first edition of Funny Stuff, a half-hour program dedicated to the art of the comedy record. We'll be dividing our time fairly evenly between the wonderful classics you might not have heard in the last few years and some obscure treasures you may never have heard. Tonight, we'll listen to an example of the purest form of comedy record, that of the stand-up comedian recorded live in front of an audience, one man, one mic. The man is Woody Allen, and in the brief time he practiced the art of stand-up comedy, he mastered it like few have, before or since, both in the material and the execution. I'm consistently amazed how few of even his hardcore fans are aware of even the existence of these three wonderful albums, recorded between 64 and 68. Although the original editions we'll be listening to tonight are out of print and very rare, there is an excellent two-record compilation still available, which leaves very little of the material out, and which I highly recommend. Well, we've only got a half an hour show, and there's much more great material than that, so now it's time for me to stop talking, and time for you to listen to the wonderful comedy of Woody Allen.
This is my third night here. I haven't been here in about 8 months now, was the last time I was here. And since I was here last, a lot of significant things have occurred in my private life that I thought we could go over tonight and evaluate. I moved, let me start right at the very beginning. I formerly lived in Manhattan, uptown east in a brownstone building, but I was constantly getting mugged and assaulted and sadistically beaten about the face and neck. So I moved into a doorman apartment house on Park Avenue that's rich and secure and expensive and great, and I lived there for 2 weeks, and my doorman attacked me. I was also out to Hollywood since I was here last. I was out to, I played a room called The Crescendo in Hollywood, California, and I ran into my ex-wife, who I did not recognize, with her wrists closed. She was annoyed at me because on television I said that she was one of the few white Muslims in New York. She's a fabulous lady, however. She, the Museum of Natural History found her shoe based on the measurements. They reconstructed a dinosaur. I don't know what else has happened. Oh, I know. I became a corporation since I was here the last time. Last year I had difficulty with my income tax. I tried to take my analyst off as a business deduction, you know. The government said that it was entertainment, you know. We compromised finally and made it a religious contribution, you know. And I formed the corporation this year, and I'm the president, and my mother's vice president, and my father's secretary, and my grandmother's treasurer, and my uncle's on the board of directors. And they got together the first week, and they tried to squeeze me out. I phoned a power block with my uncle, and he sent my grandmother to jail. Well, she's learning a trade, I'm happy to say. I went to NYU myself. I was a philo major there, too. I took all the abstract philosophy courses in college, like truth and beauty, and advanced truth and beauty, and intermediate truth, and Introduction to God, Death 101. And I was thrown out of NYU in my freshman year. I cheated on my metaphysics final. College, and I looked within the soul of the boy sitting next to me. They threw me out, and my mother, who is a really sensitive woman, when I was thrown out of college, she locked herself in the bathroom and took an overdose of Mahjong tiles. I was an analyst. You should know that about me. I was in group analysis when I was younger, because I couldn't afford private. I was captain of the latent paranoid softball team. We used to play all the neurotics on Sunday morning, you know? Nail biters against the bedwetters. And if you've never seen neurotics play softball, it's really funny. I used to steal second base and feel guilty and go back. Also, I have a cousin that my parents loved more than me, that really destroyed me. I have a boy cousin that went through 4 years of college and became a mutual fund salesman. And he married a very thin girl from the neighborhood who had her nose lifted by a golf pro. You know, and hit it and it just hooked up over her head. And they moved to the suburbs and they have all kinds of status symbols. They have their own home and a station wagon and fire insurance and life insurance and mutual funds, and his wife has orgasmic insurance, which is if her husband fails to satisfy her sexually, Mutual of Omaha has to pay her every month. I don't know what else to tell you about myself. I was a writer and an actor. I was a television writer, and I was not an actor. I was in acting class. We did a play in acting class by Paddy Chayefsky called Gideon, and I played the part of God in Gideon. It was typecasting. And it was method acting, so 2 weeks beforehand, I started to live the part off stage, you know? And I really came on godly. I was really fabulous. I put on a blue suit suddenly, you know? It took taxi cabs all over New York. I tipped big, because he would have. I got into a fight with a guy and I forgave him. It's true, some guy hit my fender and I said unto him, I said, be fruitful and multiply. But not in those words. Listen, I've been up here for a while, and I don't know how many out there noticed, but I do not have what you would call a stock theatrical suntan. I'm redheaded and fair-skinned, and when I go to the beach, I don't tan. I stroke. I never used to go to the beach because I come from Brooklyn. We only had Coney Island, which was an awful beach. There were rumors during the war that enemy submarines, German subs, came into the bathing area at Coney Island, and they were destroyed by the pollution. And the only time I bathed was with Mrs. Allen, I guess, my wife, the dread Mrs. Allen. Honeymooning. I was fabulous. You would have adored me. I was on water skis, stripped to the waist, skiing fast across the top of the surf, my hair back. I oiled my muscle. It's really holding on with one hand, water skiing, very great. My wife was in the boat ahead of me, rowing frantically. And I got a very bad burn, really bad. And I was thinking when I was a kid, I was ashamed of having red hair because I lived in a tough section. I lived in a sub-basement walk-down, under-street level, janitor-style. The janitor at our apartment during the Depression had some stocks. And the market crashed, and he was wiped out, and he tried to kill himself by jumping out the window up onto street level. I was the sensitive kid, poet. There were tough kids in my class. There was a kid in my class named Floyd, the black leather jacket, and the boots, and zipper, and acne and everything. You know? Floyd used to sit in the dumb row in school, you know? Vegetable mentality, you know? I made friends with him years later when we got older. I removed a thorn from his paw, you know? Once I was on my way for my violin lesson when I was a kid. You know, I was one of those kids who took. And I'm walking past the pool room, and Floyd and all his friends are out. You know, they're swiping hubcaps in Brooklyn from moving cars, which is really amazing. And I walk past, and he yells out to me, "Hey, Red." I was a cocky kid. Put down my violin. I go up to him. I said, "My name is not Red. If you want me, call me by my regular name. It's Master Haywood Allen." I spent that winter in a wheelchair. A team of doctors labored to remove a violin. Lucky it wasn't a cello. I'm not a fighter. I have bad reflexes and I can't fight. I was once run over by a car with a flat tire being pushed by two guys. And I was not in the army, in case you're wondering. I was in the canine corps. Strange story, when I was younger, I wanted a dog, and we had no money. My father at the time was caddy at a miniature golf course in Brooklyn. I couldn't get a dog, because it was too much, and they finally opened up in my neighborhood in Flatbush, a damaged pet shop. They sold damaged pets at discount, you know, you could get a bent pussycat if you wanted. A straight camel, you know. I got a dog that stuttered. That's why the cats would give him a hard time, and he would go bow wow. He'd turn all red, you know. And we wanted to send him into the army, but the papers got crossed up, and they got me instead of him. I was in the canine corps for 2 weeks. Me and 11 dogs was the outfit. Taught me how to heal. Sergeant was a little Mexican hairless, you know? I was not in the regular army. I was classified 4P by the draft board. In the event of war, I'm a hostage. When I was a little boy, I wanted a dog desperately. And we had no money. I was a tiny kid. And my parents couldn't get me a dog because we just didn't have the money. So they got me, instead of a dog, they told me it was a dog. They got me an ant. And I didn't know any better, you know. I thought it was a dog. I was a dumb kid. I called it Spot. I trained it, you know. I'm coming home late one night, and Sheldon Finkelstein tried to bully me. Spot was with me. And I said, "Kill!" And Sheldon stepped on my dog. Strange life. Time checking. I wanted to flash this watch. I flash it all the time. It's my antique pocket watch, and it makes me look British. And I need that for my analysis. So. It is a gorgeous gold pocket watch, however. I am proud of it. Mostly my grandfather, on his deathbed, sold me this watch. My grandfather was a very insignificant man, actually. At his funeral, his hearse followed the other cars. It was a nice funeral, though. You would have liked it. It was a catered funeral. It was held in a big hall with accordion players. And on the buffet table, there was a replica of the deceased in potato salad. Oh, I wanted to discuss my marriage.
That's important.
My marriage, or as it was known, the Oxbow incident. I had a rough marriage. Well, my wife was an immature woman, and that's all I can say. See if this is not immature to you. I would be home in the bathroom taking a bath, and my wife would walk right in whenever she felt like and sink my boats. It was partially my fault that we got divorced. I had a lousy attitude toward her. For the first year of marriage, I had a bad ass, basically a bad attitude. I guess I tended to place my wife underneath a pedestal all the time. We used to argue and fight. We finally decided we'd either take a vacation in Bermuda or get a divorce, one of the two things. And we discussed it very maturely, and we decided on the divorce because we felt that we had a limited amount of money to spend, you know. A vacation in Bermuda's over in 2 weeks, but a divorce is something that you always have. So. And I saw myself free again, living in the village, you know, in a bachelor apartment with a wood-burning fireplace and a shaggy rug, you know, and on the wall some of those great Picassos by Van Gogh, and just great swinging airline hostesses running amok in the apartment, you know. And I got very excited, and I ran into my wife. She was in the next room at the time, listening to Connell Rad on the radio. And I laid it right on the line with her. I came right to the point. I said, Quasimodo, I want a divorce. And she said, great, get the divorce. But it turns out, in New York State, they have a strange law that says you can't get a divorce unless you can prove adultery. And that is weird, because the Ten Commandments say, thou shalt not commit adultery. But New York State says you have to. For a while there, it's like a toss-up between God and Rockefeller. So I figured one of us has got to commit adultery to get the divorce. I volunteered. Because I thought it would be a fairly simple matter for me, and that I am basically a stud, you know, and it would be a... It so happens that not long ago I sold the memoirs of my love life to Parker Brothers, and they're going to make it into a game. I'm thin but fun. Anyhow, when you're married and out of circulation, there's not that many women that you know that you can have a thing with. And the only woman I knew was my wife's best friend, Nancy. So I called up Nancy on the phone, and I asked her if she would have adultery with me. And she said, not even if it would help the space program. Which I took as a negative at the time. But I didn't give up because I'm very gamey. I worked at that time in an insurance office, Midtown, New York. I ran a baseball pool in a tremendous insurance office. And we had an office party that was very Roman. A lot of groping, and the mimeo machines were running, and the paper cutters. And I had too much to drink, and I had a little secretary off the floor. And I was running her through the Thermofax machine in the office, and trying to increase my chances. And I pushed her in the mimeo room, and I went in after her, and I told her I wanted to have adultery with her. And I told her it was nothing personal. I said my lawyer required it for legal. And she didn't take too kindly to that idea. And she had a suggestion of her own. But it was impossible. It wouldn't have worked. I thought about it for a while. Not even for an engineering major. Anyhow, what finally happened, I went in my neighborhood. There's this great bar, the Agnostic Bagel Shop. traffics in professional type women that earn their living through advanced fondling. There was at the bar a trollop. Real tip-top trollop, though. Mascara on the lips, you know, and pure stuff. And I explained my situation to her, and she was very willing, but too expensive. And the plan was that if I could convince her that I was still attending New York University, I qualified for a student discount. That's in the bulletin at NYU. What finally happened was my wife committed adultery for me. She's always been more mechanically inclined than I was. Went to New York University, and I was in love in my freshman year. But I did not marry the first girl that I fell in love with because there was a tremendous religious conflict at the time. She was an atheist, and I was an agnostic, you know. We didn't know which religion not to bring the children up in. And I bummed around for a long time, and I met my wife, and we got married against my parents' wishes. We were married in Long Island, in New York. We were married by a reform rabbi in Long Island. A very reform rabbi. A Nazi. It was a very nice affair, you know, really good. And right after the wedding, my wife started turning weird. She went to Hunter College, and she got into the philosophy department at Hunter, and she started dressing with black clothes and no makeup and leotards, you know, and she pierced her ears one day with a conductor's punch. And she used to involve me in deep philosophical arguments and then prove that I didn't exist, you know, which was infuriating. And I had to let her go, was what happened. And I had to tell my parents about it. And my parents are what you would call old world. My parents come from Brooklyn, which is the heart of the old world. They're very stable, down-to-earth people who don't approve of divorce. Their values in life are God and carpeting. I came home on a Sunday. This was a long time ago. My father's watching television Sunday night. He's watching the Ed Sullivan Show on television. He's watching the Indiana Home for the Criminally Insane Glee Club on the Ed Sullivan Show. And my mother's in the corner knitting a chicken. And I said that I had to get a divorce. My mother put down her knitting. She got up and she went over to the furnace. And she opened the door and she got in. Took it rather badly, I thought. I'm going to tell a love story now, because you have background material on me. This occurred before I was married. A long time ago in Manhattan. I was in Manhattan. I was at City Center. This was ages ago. I was watching a ballet at City Center. And I'm not a ballet fan at all, but they were doing The Dying Swan. And there was a rumor that some bookmakers had drifted into town from upstate New York and that they had fixed the ballet. Apparently there was a lot of money bet on the swan to live. You know? And I'm there with my great Italian suit on. I look great. I had on a thin, tight, suffocating, sexy suit, you know, with a lot of buttons up the front there. And both my legs go into one pant on it down the side. You know. I'm really thin and aces. And I look in the box and I see a girl. And my weak spot is women. And so I always think someday they're going to make me a birthday party and wheel out a tremendous birthday cake and a giant naked woman is going to leap out of the cake and hurt me and leap back in. And I'm gonna... So I pick up this girl. I was very glib. And she was a brilliant girl. She was a Bennington girl. Studying at Bennington to be a woman male nurse in a four-year program. Working on a term paper on the increasing incidence of heterosexuality amongst homosexuals. And she lived with, when I was dating her, a painter, a sort of a post-impressionist, mock, pseudo-psychotic neo-quasi-Cretan painter who had, in a burst of artistic integrity, when I tried to cut off his ear in her apartment. Unfortunately, he had tried it with an electric razor. You have to do this all the time, you know, it's really depressing. The girl was a swinger, however, I must. The girl was brought up in Darien, Connecticut. And when she was younger, she had a little brother, about 6 years old, 8 years old, and the parents sent the kid to military school. And while he was there, he stole jam or something, and they caught him. And they wanted to do things right, because it was military school. So they held a court-martial there. And they found the kid guilty, and they shot him. They returned to his parents half the tuition. And all the name tapes went back and everything, and the rubber sheet, you know, and all that. And meanwhile, I was running amok with his sister. His sister was fabulous. She was a great, great blonde, and she had tattooed on the inner surface of her thigh the words, "Bird lives," which, unfortunately, I was never privileged to see in the relationship, but had it been printed in Braille, I would have had a great thing going with that. We used to go up to her apartment late at night, and all her beatnik friends would be sitting cross-legged on each other there, and they'd be trying to make opium out of poppies given out by veterans on street corners. We used to plug in her $12.50 hi-fi set, you know, with the teak wood needle, and put on the record albums of Marcel Marceau, you know, just... She broke off with me. She was a brilliant girl. She'd won a scholarship to secretarial school. The government sent her to Switzerland to study typing or something. She was ultimately run over by a freedom bus.
Oh, that's wonderful stuff. Just wonderful. It was Woody Allen from 1964 and an album entitled Woody Allen, one of three albums that he made. This one, for reasons I've been totally unable to deduce, came with recipes on the back. It had a wonderful black and white picture of him on the front. Looks great. If some of this material sounded familiar to you, he's gone back to these early albums and used pieces of them in many of his movies. There's much more great Woody Allen material, so pretty soon we'll have to go back and spend another half an hour with Woody Allen. Well, that'll have to do it for tonight. We'll be preempted next week due to a chamber music concert, but 2 weeks from tonight, I hope you'll be able to join me for a program with Peter Cook and Dudley Moore, the brilliant British comedy team. Those of you who are fans of Cook and Moore will especially be entertained, because I've got quite a bit of very rare stuff of theirs that's hardly ever heard on this side of the Atlantic. Well, that'll wrap it up for tonight. This is your host, Bob Claster, asking you to join me in 2 weeks for the program with Peter Cook and Dudley Moore. Try to keep the smile going until then, and remember, as long as you've got your sense of humor, you'll never walk alone. Good night, everybody.